So hi, everyone. Thank you for coming to Dr. Lakshin's class today. I'm just going to give a quick recap of some upcoming classes. Tomorrow morning, Rambam, a Man of Letters with Dr. Sokolow continues at 10:30 a.m. Eastern. Tomorrow evening, we have our weekly Parshat Shavua class at 8:30 p.m. Eastern. This week, it's with Dr. Aaron Koller. And finally, Tisha B'Av is soon approaching. Torah in Motion will be hosting an online day of learning for that. And I'll post a link to the webpage, the Tisha B'Av webpage in the chat for those who are interested. So with that, thank you all for being here. Thank you, Dr. Lakshin. And I hope everyone has a wonderful Shiur.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I just want to make one further announcement, which is that for those of you who come regularly, I just wanted to mention that 2 weeks from now, there is not going to be a class. It's the festival here in Jerusalem called the World Congress for Jewish Studies. And they scheduled the talk that I'm giving to this convention precisely at the time that the Torah in Motion class takes place. So 2 weeks from now, there will not be a class. I'll share with you my screen and we'll get to work. Well, be doing some interesting and perhaps slightly controversial texts today, and I assume that there'll be some reactions to them, and that'll be great, and we'll have some time at the end for comments, written comments on the chat, and perhaps for oral comments too. So we've been going through, just to review, we've been going through Parshat Mishpatim, the 21st chapter of Exodus, and now we began last week looking at these verses, and we talked about one aspect of these verses, but perhaps not the most interesting and not the most controversial aspect of these verses. When men fight and one of them pushes a pregnant woman and a miscarriage results, this is the standard translation. This is the JPS translation, but almost all translations translate this way. We'll see that actually there's a big question about how to translate this passage. But anyways, we'll start with the common understanding. Men fight. One of them pushes a pregnant woman and a miscarriage results, but no other damage ensues. The one responsible shall be fined according as the woman's husband may exact from him the payment to be based on reckoning. But if other damage ensues, the penalty shall be life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, bruise for bruise. So as I said, we started looking at this last week, and we really only discussed the implications of the first six Hebrew words, v'chi yinatsu anashim v'nagafu isha hara. So the Talmudic discussion, to even decide what's the theme of these verses, you know, until now it's been kind of simple figuring out what the theme is of the sections that we're looking at. But as we saw last week, and as we'll see this week, finding all the themes, the issues that are being discussed here is difficult. The first issue, it's not the one that people that people talk about most often, but I think it's also an interesting question. The text begins, men are fighting and one of them pushes a woman. The fact that she's pregnant becomes relevant in the continuation, but the question, the Talmud in its analysis of this text talks a lot about the question of intentionality. Is this referring really to intentional damages? And what do we consider to be intentional in damages if two people are fighting with each other? Two men are fighting with each other and one of them pushes a woman. As Rashi says here, the Natsu Anashim Ze Im Ze, I think the Rashi is understanding it in the standard way that most people have read this text, that it's referring to people who their intentionality is to be doing damage. They're fighting with each other. They're trying to hurt each other, and they end up hurting an innocent bystander. And if this text is talking, as we'll see in the continuation, if this text is talking about a case where the woman dies, then we have the fascinating halachic issue that I mentioned last week. We're not going to go over it again this week. The fascinating halachic issue of mitkaven laharog etzeh v'harag etzeh. A person has intentionality to kill one person, but ends up killing somebody else who wasn't the person that they were trying to kill. Do we call that first-degree murder? Do we call that intentionality? If somebody is trying to hurt or trying to kill, but is not trying to kill the person that they end up killing. So that's the first issue that scholars, beginning with the Talmud and going on through the generations, discuss in relationship to these verses. We're not going to go over that a second time now. That was last week's topic. And now we're going to move on to what is really the interesting part of this text, which is the relevance of this text to the abortion debate. What is this text saying about the status of the fetus? So again, looking back at the text itself, just for a second, men are fighting, and one of them pushes a pregnant woman, and there is a miscarriage. So in this understanding of the text, there's a miscarriage, but no other damage ensues. Then there is a monetary penalty. But if other damage ensues, then it is something else. So the other damage is generally understood in the Jewish tradition of interpretation. It has always been understood as damage to the woman. So again, like the first paragraph here is talking about what happens if there is damage to the fetus, that the fetus ends up dying, a miscarriage results, then there's a monetary penalty. But if other damage ensues, is understood as essentially meaning that the woman dies. So Ibn Ezra basically represents the standard Jewish understanding. This isn't just Ibn Ezra. You can find this in almost all Jewish commentators, except some of the ones that I'm going to be referring to in the continuation. But this is the standard Jewish understanding of the text. The lo yiyeh ason la'isha, if men fight, a pregnant woman gets pushed, there is a miscarriage. The lo yiyeh ason la'isha, but there is no ason. Ason, it's a modern Hebrew word, it's a biblical Hebrew word. That means a disaster, a tragedy, something terrible. When Jacob is saying that he doesn't want the brothers to take Benjamin down to Egypt, he says that if you take him away, the karahu ason, some tragedy might happen, some terrible thing might happen to him if you take him down to Egypt. And so the simplest understanding here of ason is that it means the loss of human life, and it's not referring to the life of the fetus. That what happened here is there is no ason to the woman, but there is a fine because of the miscarriage, as Ibn Ezra says, anosh yanesh, ba'avur hayiladim sheyatzu v'metu. That the fine is because of the undesired termination of the pregnancy. So it's clear that in this understanding, as Rashi concludes from what we'll see in a second, but before we go to Rashi, just to see how the rules about fetuses and full-fledged women showed up in the Code of Hammurabi, which is hundreds of years almost the millennium before the writing of Parshat Mishpatim. So in this, the Code of Hammurabi, around 1700 BC, here is what they say about a situation like this: that a man has struck a free woman with child and has caused her to miscarriage, he shall pay 10 shekels for her miscarriage. If the woman die, his daughter shall be killed. The Court of Hammurabi loved penalties like this, where you're not actually punishing the person who is guilty of the act, but if you cause somebody to lose their a woman in their family, then a woman in your family will be lost in exchange. And so you can see, just looking at paragraph 209 and 210 of the Code of Hammurabi, they're also making the same distinction. It's very different from what the Torah said, but they're, this idea that there's a difference between the a miscarriage, a miscarriage that occurs against the will of the woman is very different from the death of a human being. As the Code of Hammurabi often does, it depends, it goes through the rules looking to see what status this woman had in society. So the first time it was a free woman, a woman who wasn't born a slave, an aristocratic woman, then this is this kind of penalty. And if by a blow he has caused a plebeian's daughter to have a miscarriage, then it's half the penalty. He shall pay 5 shekels of silver. And if that woman has died, he shall pay 1/2 mina of silver. Then, you know, for some human beings, some human beings have the status of, they have to be revenged avenged with the death of another human being. But the Code of Hammurabi makes this distinction clearly here. And if he struck a free man's female slave in 213 and has caused her to have a miscarriage, it's an even smaller penalty. He shall pay 2 shekels of silver. And if that female slave has died, he shall pay 1/3 of a mina of silver. So you see, different human beings have different value to them. Different fetuses have value to them. But looking at 209 and 210 in the Code of Hammurabi, it's very clear that the penalty for a miscarriage, even of an aristocratic woman having a miscarriage that she did not want to have, is a financial penalty. And if the aristocratic woman herself dies, and there is a more serious penalty, a kind of life-for-life penalty. Not in the way that Jewish texts would understand life-for-life, but the sense of somebody else from the family ends up dying. This idea of the distinction that exists between the status of the fetus and the status of a full-fledged human being shows up in Rashi's commentary on the Gemara in Tractate Sanhedrin in the discussion of there's a Mishnah that is quoted in Sanhedrin. It comes from Masechet Ohalot, which does not have any Babylonian Talmud. But the Babylonian Talmud on Sanhedrin is discussing the Mishnah from Ohalot that talks about a woman who is having difficulty in childbirth and there is danger to somebody's life. The Mishnah makes it very clear that as long as the baby hasn't been born, the life of the mother takes precedence over the fetus. Even if the fetus is at the end of the 9th month, is just about to be born, but if the fetus is still inside of the mother, then this fetus does not have the status of a human being. And that's what Rashi says here in stark language here. The holzman shelo yatsa la'avir ha'olam, as long as the fetus has not come out of the womb, lav nefeshu. It isn't a nefesh. It isn't, in simple English, it is not a human life. But talking about what is and is not a human life. Human life begins at birth, is what Rashi is saying in this comment. And so since the mother is a nefesh, the mother is a human being, and since the child is lav nefesh, it's not a nefesh, then of course there is no ethical dilemma here. It is clear that the mother's life takes precedence over the life of the fetus. And so Rashi is not a new halachic decision here. This is very clear from the Mishnah on. And you can argue that it's also clear just from the study of this text in Parshat Mishpatim that's what the Bible is saying about the status of the fetus and the status of a human being. But we do have this kind of a stark formulation here: lav nefesh hu, that a fetus in the ninth month, at the end of the ninth month, that just hasn't been born yet. The phrase that is used in the Mishnah is Yatzah Rosho Verubo, that the status of the fetus changes to that of a human being when, and there's a translation issue here of how to translate Rosho Verubo. It might mean the head and the majority of the body, or it might mean the head or the majority of the body. If it's a breech birth or something like this, and you could have the majority of the body having come out with the head hasn't come out. And a few weeks ago, we studied the question of whether vav always means and, or sometimes it means or, and we saw a number of examples when it means or, but it's a technical question. The life of the fetus, according considering the fetus to be a human life, is only once a fair amount of the birthing process has taken place. Rosho Verubo, however you're going to translate that phrase, Rosho Verubo. So that's, you know, when Jews talk about the issue of the status of the fetus, and when they talk about the very controversial issue of abortion, this text gets quoted frequently. And another text that gets quoted frequently is a common Talmudic principle that says, Ubar Yerech Imo. The fetus is tantamount to the thigh of the mother. Or put into the standard language that we would use today, the fetus is part of the body of the mother. And so these are two principles that get discussed frequently when people are discussing the issue of abortion today. When does the fetus begin to be a human life? And Rashi says here, it isn't the nefesh until it has actually been born. And the Talmud also says frequently that the fetus is to be considered part of the life of the mother. When I used to teach courses in Jewish ethics at York University, I used to say that the common pro-choice argument usually has three legs to the argument. You know, the first leg is the fetus is not a human life. The second leg of the argument is the fetus is part of the life of the mother. And those two arguments are plain and simply, you just see, this is very clearly the Talmudic understanding based on, I think, the reasonable traditional Jewish reading of this text in Parashat Mishpatim. But the third leg of the pro-choice argument is always a woman has the right to do whatever she wants to do with her own body. And that's the question. That's what makes abortion into a topic of discussion still in Jewish circles, because there is a principle in Jewish law. Rambam writes here, Asur la'adam lachbol ben ba'atzmo ben ba'chavero. People are not allowed to cause injury neither to themselves nor to others. So Jewish ethics say that not only am I not allowed to cause injury to somebody else's body, I'm not allowed to cause injury to my own body. Now, of course, there are situations when I am allowed to cause injury to my own body. If I've got gangrene growing and I wish to cut off a limb in order so that the gangrene does not kill me, then of course I'm allowed to do this. And there are other things that we do that could be considered in some sense harming one's body that might be permitted because of some kind of higher good that comes out of doing it. And so that's why in traditional Jewish texts, there is a discussion about abortion because in the example, that Mishnah that I quoted, in that Mishnah, it's understood that you can kill the fetus in order to save the life of the mother. So that's a higher good because the mother is a human life and the fetus, as Rashi said, lav nefesh. It's not a full fledged human life and so this leads to all of the discussions in Jewish ethical texts. What are other reasons that might justify terminating a pregnancy, and that's why in Jewish law there is a discussion. That there isn't an opinion in Jewish law, in standard Jewish law, that life begins at conception, and there isn't an opinion that the fetus is to be seen as being separate from the mother, as there is in some other religious traditions. So we'll have more to say about that in the continuation. And this idea of not harming oneself shows up also. This is a source that I don't quote very often. It's the first Lubavitcher Rebbe, Rabbi Shneur Zalman of Yadi, wrote, "Asur lahakot et chaveru afilu hu noten lo reshut." He ain't Adam reshut al gufo klal. It's forbidden for one person to strike another person, even with the permission of the other person, since people do not have control of their own bodies at all. And so if I tell you to harm me, I ask you to harm me, you're not allowed to do it because I don't have the right to give permission to somebody to harm my own body. And he also writes, for this reason, it's also forbidden to harm oneself or even to cause pain to oneself. That because our bodies were given to us as a gift from God, therefore we have to exercise respect towards our bodies. And if the fetus is part of the body of the mother, then the same rules in theory apply for doing something that affects the fetus as doing something that harms the body of the adult. So it's not my goal today to try to get into all the intricacies of the debate over the last few hundred years on the issue of abortion in Jewish law, but what I want people to see is the basis for the fact that the Jewish traditional position is very different from the position of other religions that have argued that life begins at conception and have reached far sweeping positions advocating restricting any kind of access to abortion because of a desire to protect human life. So the traditional Jewish understanding is Rashi's understanding, lav nefesh, the fetus is not a human life until it is born. Okay, so that is the traditional Jewish understanding of the text. The oldest translation of the Bible is the translation of the Septuagint, translation done by Jews like 2,200 years ago. Jews living in Egypt, the standard translation of the Bible into Greek. There's a tradition in some traditional texts that says that the translation is called the Septuagint, which comes from the Greek word meaning 70. In Hebrew, it's called Targum HaShivim, the translation of the 70 elders. The tradition, the midrash, if you like, behind this text is that the King Ptolemy in Egypt wanted to know what it said in the Bible, but he didn't trust the Jews. And so he found 70 scholars to sit in 70 booths and wouldn't let them communicate with each other and asked each of them to translate the Bible. And a miracle occurred, and they all translated the Bible the precise same way, even changing a couple of passages, which they thought that King Ptolemy might not like. They introduced some changes, but divine inspiration caused them to all come up with the same translation of the text. That's the kind of the midrash about where the Septuagint came from. The standard scholarly understanding today is that just like Jews in the United States and in Canada are interested in reading the Bible in English, so Jews who were living in the Greek-speaking community in Alexandria in Egypt needed a Greek translation. In other words, the Bible was translated into Greek for internal Jewish purposes, because this whole idea that somebody other than a Jew at this point in history, 2,200 years ago, would be interested in knowing in detail what the Bible says, it does seem unlikely. So the Septuagint comes up with an extremely strange translation of this same passage.
So here's an English translation of the
Greek translation of the Bible.
Now, if two men fight and they strike a pregnant woman,
and her child comes forth not fully formed, v'lo ye'ason, for some really strange and, as far as I'm concerned, totally ununderstandable reason, the Septuagint translates the word ason as meaning form. Lo ye'ason means that the fetus does not have a form, which is usually understood. I don't know what this really means, but the standard understanding is that it means that when you see the fetus, you look at it and you say, that is obviously the fetus of a human being. So the question is, does it have human form or does it not have human form? So if a miscarriage occurs, and the fetus is not fully formed, whatever that means, does not look like a human being, let's say, then he shall be punished with a fine, according as the husband of the woman might impose. He shall pay with judicial assessment. That part is fairly standard. But if it is fully formed, he shall pay life for life. So, according to this text, the fetus, when does the fetus start to be considered a human being?
It starts to be considered
a human being when it is fully formed, when the fetus looks like a human being or looks like a fully formed human being. Those of you who might have more medical knowledge than me might be able to express an opinion about at what stage of pregnancy you might say that the fetus is fully formed or that the fetus looks like a human being and doesn't look at like some other creature. It's not a conception. Clearly, the text is distinguishing between two kinds of miscarriage. A miscarriage of a child that is, of a fetus that is not fully formed, and a miscarriage of a fetus that is fully formed. So this is how some Jews in Alexandria 2,200 years ago, understood this text. As I said before, I think that there is nothing to recommend this understanding of the text. It involves really a distortion of the meaning of the word ason, which appears a number of times in Tanakh, and never does the word ason mean form in any other text in Tanakh. However, it would seem that it isn't just the Septuagint from 2,200 years ago. But if you look at the next slide, here's the Spiral of Alexandria, a proud Jew who lived in Alexandria 2,000 years ago, approximately 200 years after the Septuagint was translated into Greek. Philo is writing the description of Jewish law, and here's his understanding of what the Jewish law is about a fetus. But if anyone has a contest with a woman who is pregnant, that's not quite the understanding that we had before. But okay, if anyone has a contest with a woman who is pregnant and strike her a blow on her belly and she miscarry, if the child which was conceived within her is still unfashioned and unformed, he shall be punished by a fine, both for the assault which he committed and also because he has prevented nature, who is fashioning and preparing that most excellent of all creatures, a human being, from bringing that human being into existence. So it's like Philo is saying, there's a potential human being there. It's not a human being yet. If it's unfashioned and unformed, we won't call it a human being. But there's a penalty here because of the potentiality of life that has been taken away.
Nice thing that
human beings are the most excellent of all creatures.
But if the child which was conceived had assumed a distinct shape in all its parts, having received all its proper
connective and distinctive qualities. Again, I don't know. I'm not a physician. I don't know precisely what this means, but Philo is saying that there's a difference between a fully formed fetus and a not fully formed fetus, which is, Philo reads the Bible in Greek. Philo's Hebrew was weak. A number of times Philo makes comments about, he had some Jewish education. He went to Sunday school or he went to afternoon school or something like this and learned a little bit of Hebrew, but his Hebrew was not very strong. And so his connection to the Bible was through the Septuagint, and he thought that he was representing the biblical position here by saying this. The child which was conceived had assumed a distinct shape in all its parts, having received all of its proper connective and distinctive qualities, he shall die. For such a creature as that is a man, it's a human being whom he has slain while still in the workshop of nature. When the fetus is inside of the mother, it is in the workshop of nature. Well, Philo has a way with words that the fetus is where is in the in utero is in the workshop of nature, but it's a human being already. And so that's Philo's understanding of Jewish law based on the translation of the Septuagint that I would call a very difficult to accept understanding of the biblical verse. So this is what was going on in the Jewish circles in Alexandria 2,000 years ago. Philo presumably is representing here the values of the community in which he lived in Alexandria 2,000 years ago. And the values of that community were that when the fetus assumes a certain level of development that is not very clearly defined here, then it becomes a full-fledged human being. At the same time, in the first century or a few years after Philo, Josephus, who grew up here in Eretz Yisrael, and was acquainted with Jewish law and ethics as understood here in Eretz Yisrael. Josephus is writing before the days of the Mishnah is recorded. The Mishnah, of course, includes oral traditions that go back a very long way, but Josephus is writing around the year 100 of the Common Era, and the Mishnah isn't written down until around the year 200 of the Modern Era. So Josephus is an important document, and so he's representing what people here in Eretz Yisrael understood to be the law 1900 years ago. He that kicks a woman with child so that the woman miscarry, let him pay a fine in money, as the judges shall determine, as having diminished the multitude by the destruction of what was in her womb. It's done something wrong, and he should pay a fine for it. And let money also be given the woman's husband by him that kicked her. But if she die of the stroke, let him also be put to death. So Josephus is making, is offering the understanding of the text that we saw later on, you know, years after Josephus, is the understanding of Rashi, and it's the understanding of Ibn Ezra, and I would argue that it underlies every Talmudic text that has discussed this issue. At the beginning of my teaching career, I was teaching a course at York University, and I taught these texts. I had a student in my class who was the daughter of a pastor, and I don't remember what denomination the pastor was from. And after I taught these texts, I said, you know, here is where the standard Jewish understanding came from the understanding of the text that I just shared with you from Ibn Ezra and Rashi and people like that. And here I know where a different understanding that said that at a certain point in the pregnancy, the fetus becomes a full-fledged human life. I see where that idea comes from. But I said, I have no idea how the people who say that life begins at conception, the religious Christians who say that life begins at conception, how do they understand this biblical text? Well, my student went home to her father, the pastor, and asked him the question. And she came back the next day, and she brought me an article on the subject. You know, what the rabbis say, me tell me die, you'll tear me kulam. You know, I learned a lot from my teachers, but I've also learned even more from my students. From the daughter of this pastor, I learned how various Bible Belt kind of Christians understand this passage. And so the question comes down to, what does the Yatsu Yeladecha mean?
Thinking back to the text.
In the beginning, I said to you, the Nagafu Isha Hara, they push a pregnant woman, the Yatsu Yeladecha, which from the time that I could understand what a miscarriage was, I was always told that the words Yatsu Yeladeha means that she miscarried. But it's a really strange phrase to describe a miscarriage, Yatsu Yeladeha. There isn't a simple Hebrew locution for a miscarriage.
Shakal Shin Kaf Lamed can be used for that, but it can also be used
for the death of a child.
Kasher Shafolti
Lama Eshkal Gam Shnechem Yom Echad. Who says that? Rivka says that. Why should, you know, if you don't run away from here, Jacob, there's going to be a war between Esau and you, and you're going to end up killing each other. Why should I lose both of you on the same day? That's not talking. So sometimes shakal is used about miscarriage. Lo tiyeh mishakelava akara ba'aritzecha. There shouldn't be any, there won't be any miscarriages in your country. So there isn't really a great term that only talks about a miscarriage, because shakal can be used both for a miscarriage and for the death, particularly the death of a child. So what does the Atsuila Deha mean? So here's the article that my student brought me in 1987. And I remember when I started reading it, I said, okay, what kind of strange interpretation of the text are they going to come up with here? And then when I read it, I said, okay, how strange is this? So the conservative Christian position from this article from 1987, the translation miscarriage in Exodus 21:22 by many well-known English Bible translations is misleading, if not correct. We assume, read the author of the article, assumes that the blow to the pregnant woman led to a premature birth. Nothing in the text requires us to think that the fetus is born dead. The Yatsu Yavadeha, but the, you know, when you think about it, about these words, the Yatsu Yavadeha, that's
the child or the children came up. So it can. This is not
a crazy reading of the text that suggests. So reading the text this way, you come up with the following understanding of the text. When men fight and one of them pushes a pregnant woman and the offspring come out prematurely. You know, you might even argue, I'm trying to make a case for this, even though this is not the traditional Jewish understanding. I'm not
advocating
for this, but I'm just trying to make a case for the fact that this is not a crazy reading of the Hebrew. Is it possible that the Torah uses a phrase like the Yatsu Yeladeha, which is a really unusual phrase, because it's like it's ambiguous. It could mean that the child came out alive, or it could mean that the child came out dead. It could be referring to a miscarriage, or it could be referring to a birth. And if that is the case, then the two options coming up after this are: one of them pushes a pregnant woman and the offspring come out prematurely. If no other damage ensues, meaning that this baby that came out early, that survives this birth that was forced on the mother, this early birth that was forced on the mother, the one responsible shall be fined according as the woman's husband may exact from him, the payment to be based on reckoning. This woman was still put through an experience that she didn't want to go through, which was giving birth early, and she gave birth early because of this assault, and there should be a payment of a fine for a situation like this. But if other damage ensues, meaning if the fetus comes out damaged, the penalty shall be life for life. So this is how those people who argue that human life begins at conception read this text in the book of Exodus. And when I started reading about this subject, I discovered that there were also some Jews over the years who read the text in this way. Judah Hadasi, a Karaite, writing in the 12th century. So the Karaites, just to review, of course, are those Jews who do not accept the authority of the Talmud, do not accept the interpretations that are found in the Talmud, who claim that they are going back to just like a unmediated reading of the biblical text. It's very unlikely that Judah Hadasi was influenced by any contact with any Christians on this subject, but just he, looking at the text, he writes, if there's an asong from the fighting, ba o biladeha, either to the woman or to her offspring, this falls under you shall not kill in the Torah. So Judah Hadasi is supporting many years before article that I read in the 1980s is supporting this reading of the biblical text, of arguing that that this text is saying that life essentially begins at conception. And he's not the only Karaite. I found another Karaite who said the same thing, Aaron ben Elijah, the Karaite, writes, and there is no ason, neither to the woman nor to the offspring, then he shall be fine. What is he fine for? Mipnesha sidev tsar laisha, for the suffering that he caused to the woman, not because of a miscarriage, but because the woman suffered by going through this this procedure.
And as I was doing more and more
reading about this this subject, the most shocking thing to me was the commentary on Exodus written by Casuto. Umberto Casuto, later Moshe David Casuto, was an Orthodox rabbi in Italy who moved here to Israel and became the first professor of Bible at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. He's an interesting character who, as an Orthodox rabbi, was a traditionalist in many ways, but in the same way that Rashbam will offer shot readings of the biblical text that go against the grain of halacha. He says, you know, okay, I know what halacha is, but you want to know what the pshat is? Here is the pshat of the text. So Casuto wrote a commentary on Exodus in which he writes, her children emerge because of the pushing, and there is no ason. In other words, neither the woman nor the offspring die. Then the one who pushed her will be fined a monetary amount imposed on him by the woman's husband, commensurate with the amount of damages and the specific conditions of the accident. So Casuto is arguing, you know, he's not trying to present a halakhic understanding of the text. He's presenting what he thinks is the simplest reading of the biblical text. And that's how he understood what the phrase, the Yatsu Yevadeha, here implies. When I was preparing for this session, I was just fooling around on the internet, looking to see if I could find this is my translation of Casuto. You've got the Hebrew on the left, but I was looking to see whether maybe I could find the official translation of Casuto. And what I found was that all sorts of right-wing Protestant websites quote Casuto on this issue. They discovered a Jew, a rabbi, an Orthodox rabbi, who interprets the verse, who says that the shot of this verse is the one that was offered here by James K. Hoffmeyer and by other traditional Christians. Okay, is there any way of summing up what we have seen here today on this subject? I'm going to try. There is no doubt what the halakhic understanding of the text is. And the halakhic understanding of I, as a halakhic Jew, I live a life that is based on the halakhic understanding of the Torah. And so what we saw from Rashi and from Ibn Ezra and from the Mishnah is very clear, that the traditional Jewish understanding of this text leads to the traditional Jewish understanding that a fetus is not a human life, that life does not begin at conception. It's a fascinating question. What is the text?
What's the shot of the text actually mean?
Yeah. It took me actually a number of years of reading about this until I came to the conclusion that the traditional right-wing Christian reading of the text is not a crazy reading of the text. It's not based on, it's not crazy. Like the Septuagint is a crazy reading of the text. Pardon me for using unprofessional language, but the Septuagint understanding of the text is baseless. It's based on understanding the word ason as meaning shape, which is totally unprecedented, and I would say totally impossible. This reading of the text that the Yatsu Yiladeha does not mean miscarriage, but that the Yatsu Yiladeha is a term that describes a fetus coming out of the uterus, either dead or alive. But the same phrase, the Yatsu Yiladeha, might cover both of those situations. It's not an impossible reading of the biblical text. And so when people try to cite the Bible as having a clear message on this subject, like many things in biblical interpretation, it's very hard to find a clear, unambiguous message on the subject when you're doing biblical interpretation. When you're doing halachic analysis, as I said in the beginning, it's clear that there is only one halachic understanding of this text, which is that halacha understood this text as teaching us that life does not begin at conception. That, as Rashi puts it, a fetus, lav nefeshu, it's not a human life until birth actually takes place. And that's the basis for any traditional Jewish non-Karaite understanding of the issue. Okay, I'm going to stop here and see what kind of comments there might be here in the chat. To hit another person, RMA, police, training, spectator sports like boxing, Olympics. So yeah, could be discussing something like that. Medical testing new drugs can also harm a person. Yes, that's a very interesting question. I always wondered about the people who volunteer for various tests, even the people who volunteered for tests of vaccine before they were proven. And even more than that, I wondered about people who volunteered their children for tests of vaccine before they were proven. On the other hand, we're kind of glad that they did. Okay, question. Lauren asked, do any other religions other than Christianity believe that life begins at conception? Lauren, I don't know the answer to that. Maybe somebody else here does.
And would like to chime in,
but I don't know. Okay, Susanna writes, fully formed might mean formed, fully functional, which would be much later than having all its parts, about 12 or 13 weeks. You're right, Susanna, that might be what it means. Fully formed might mean, it could even mean viable, which is something that, you know, were the fetus to come out, would it be able to sustain life? It's possible that, but from the way that Philo put it, that, you know, all the connectives are there, that it might be describing viability, which is a much later stage of, okay. Zamira writes, absolutely no thought is given to the pregnant mother, her health, her feelings, or her rights. I'm not sure about that, Zamira. They're saying, you know, in these texts that she gets, that there is a fine here because she was damaged. Okay. Why the plural Yiladeha? Susanna asks. No good explanation. I've read many explanations. I've never read any good explanation of why it says Yiladeha in the plural. In general, would a posek ever consider a Karaite opinion as a halachic source? Marty Crossell asks, and the answer is never, not in a million years, would any rabbinite posek be willing to look. I only as a, you know, as a historian, as a teacher about, you know, what some Jews, just like I thought about what Jews in Alexandria thought about the subject, I also thought about what Karaite Jews thought about the subject, but it has no status that any posek, any halakhic decisor would ever consider. Is it possible that the translators of the Septuagint had a different Hebrew text? Yes, people have made that suggestion. I don't know what it would be, but people have suggested this. Did the Christian understanding come out of being a persecuted minority at first to prevent abortions to get numbers up? Who knows? Some interesting thought. Never heard that, but I can't rule it out. What is the value of potential life within halakha? Is there, are there cognition, you know, Nietzsche asks, you know, I like the language of Philo, even though I didn't like his conclusion that, you know, that there's the workshop of nature is
manufacturing a human life. It's some understanding of some kind of potentiality of life. Remember, the men in Egypt, the Midrash, did not want to have children. That's true, I guess.
By that point in medication testing, the drug has gone through phase one and two to determine toxicity and safe dosing. Good. So I shouldn't feel bad about the people who volunteered to be guinea pigs in experiments. Islam appears to be quite liberal about abortion. Irene asks, thank you for that. Is there a recognition of the scale of loss? So, some of the common, you know, the phrase here, Anoshi Anesh Kasher Yashita Labal Haisha Venatan Biflilim. The word biflilim could mean in front of judges, that the case is brought to judges to adjudicate. But it could also mean that the fine would depend on how far along in the pregnancy. It could mean that there's some kind of judgment going on.
And it could,
and I guess maybe the scale of loss of that this is some woman who doesn't have any children. I don't know. And I don't think there is any case law about this issue. Okay, let's see, more than one relative of mine here. Hello, relatives, nice to see you.
Good to see you, Marty.
Okay, hello, Adam Ruth, and hi, Sally. I'll see you next week. I can't guarantee that it'll be as interesting and as controversial as this week, but we'll see what we can do about that. In the meantime, all have a good week. And just a reminder that 2 weeks from now, there is no session on Wednesday. Okay, all the best.
Marty, I just want to have one suggestion that I have?
Sure, Gershon, go ahead.
Ason resonates with Esav.
With Esav.
And Yaakov was a potential aborter.
Huh. Okay, and that maybe connects to that shakal that I mentioned that is used about in the discussion of Yaakov and Esav. Thank you, Gershon. All the best, everyone. See you next week if you can make it.
Thank you so much, Dr. Lakshin. Have a great day, everyone.
Thank you.